Support for NPR podcasts comes from A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In the neoconservative camp that pushed for war with Iraq, Norman Podhoretz is a great patriarch, one of the old originals. But he's hardly out to pasture. He's a senior advisor to Rudy Giuliani. He counsels George Bush in the White House. And here's what he's saying. We are in the midst of World War IV, a life and death super struggle with Islamofascism. We should bomb Iran. And anyone who doesn't agree is a threat to the nation. Hawks love him. Critics say he's hysterical and dangerous. He's still pushing. Up next on Point, Norman Podhoretz and the debate over his World War IV. Joining me now from New York is one-time leftist turned neoconservative Norman Podhoretz. He is editor-at-large for Commentary Magazine. He's a senior foreign policy advisor to presidential candidate Rudy Giuliani. His new book is called World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism. The Weekly Standard calls it instructive and important. Rush Limbaugh calls it bold and brilliant. Ian Baruma, writing the New York Review of Books, calls its arguments zany, unhinged, and a dangerous form of hysteria. One note, Mr. Podhoretz would only appear on our program without other guests on at the same time. So later in this hour, after he's said his piece, we'll hear from two critics of the Podhoretz view, retired Army general and former head of the NSA, William Odom, and from a reporter in the field, longtime Mideast correspondent Christopher Dickey of Newsweek. But first, with us from New York, Norman Podhoretz, welcome back to the show. Good to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
So let's see. How's the war going in the field and at home, if it's World War IV?
The war in the field is going reasonably well, considering that it's in the early years. I mean, we are about where we were in World War III, which was the Cold War, and I think in retrospect can be seen more precisely as World War III. We're about where we were in 1952 in World War III, and As you may recall, if you're old enough, that was a point at which we had lost well over 30,000 men in Korea, and President Harry Truman's approval ratings were 10 points lower than President Bush's are now. He didn't dare run for re-election. He was considered by most people one of the worst presidents we'd ever had. Of course, in retrospect, almost everyone now agrees that he was a great president.
I am not old enough to remember, in fact, but it was not an easy point in that confrontation with the Soviet Union. So reasonably well in the field, you say, and we'll look at that. What about at home?
Well, again, I think many parallels to the Cold War, World War III, exist both in the field and at home. There was a very strong anti-war movement that developed after the enunciation of the Truman Doctrine in 1947, which basically was the declaration of war against Soviet expansionism. And Truman was both opposed furiously and ridiculed from the left, the right, and even the center. The doctrine was very, very controversial. Many people poo-pooed the Soviet threat. They said that it was wildly exaggerated by Truman, that he was being hysterical. They said that there was more danger from Truman than from Stalin. They said that the only possible way to move was through making a deal, diplomacy. Stalin wanted peace, and it was the United States that wanted war. Group of critics coalesced eventually into an anti-war movement that reached its height of power and influence during Vietnam. And I think that the anti-war movement we have here in this country today has been working off the anti-war movement's playbook during the Vietnam period and has been achieving great successes, at least in influencing public opinion.
Let's come very much up to date, if we can, Neumann Podhoretz. The war's going reasonably well in the field. The World War IV you describe, you say. How does Iraq factor into that? That hardly seems to be the impression of most Americans, even some of those who, like you, pushed for that war. Max Boot has come on this show and said, oh, boy, you know, we're in a deep, deep bad hole there. Richard Pearl has spoken remorsefully about what's happened there. How do you see that as going reasonably well?
Well, I see Iraq as the second front to have been opened in World War IV, the first one, of course, being Afghanistan, and the likely next front is Iran. When you ask how things are going in Iraq, my question always is, compared to what? The notion that there have been calamitous mistakes made in the execution of the policy. Yeah, but I think that these mistakes, even if some of them are not even mistakes, judgment calls that might have gone worse if they'd been made the other way. But in any event, even if you stipulate that every one of the alleged mistakes actually was a mistake, I consider them what I call in my book, World War IV, chump change compared to the mistakes that were made in World War II, a war that was run by great men like Roosevelt and Churchill, where hundreds of thousands of lives were squandered by military decisions that were ill-advised, by incompetent execution of strategy, and also by simple inter-alliance politics, like the invasion of Italy, where more Americans died on the first day of the beaches of Anzio, I think, that have died since 9/11.
You know, I had an uncle in that invasion, but I want to try and keep it in the here and now. It's so urgent, and you're putting a big marquee World War IV on it.
Sure.
Islamofascism is what you say it's against. That word had a kind of moment in the sun, what was it, 18 months ago now, maybe back when you were writing this book. We hear very little about it now. Do all the players in this great big war board that you describe here fit under that label? What do you mean by Islamofascism?
Well, as the reason I like that word is that it encapsulates what I call in my book the two-headed monster against which declared war on us long before 9/11, but it took 9/11 to make us realize that and to begin fighting back. It's I call it a two-headed monster because one head is mainly religious, the other head is mainly secular. The Taliban represented the religious head most saliently, and we went after it in Afghanistan and defeated it, and set
for a time. Now they're talking about bringing it into the government there.
Well, I can get into that if you like. I mean, but
I take your point. I didn't mean to interrupt.
Yeah, and in any event, we did overthrow the Taliban regime and help to put in place the first democratically elected government in the history of that country. We then took on the main secular embodiment of the Islamo-fascist two-headed monster, represented by Saddam Hussein. And the purpose here, as enunciated in the Bush Doctrine, was to reshape the political configuration of the region. I like to summarize it as making the Middle East safe for America by making it safe for democracy. And to execute that strategy involved having to, what the president used to call, drain the swamps in which Islamofascism bred and out of which its main instrument of war, namely terrorism, was nourished, supported by various states, and which had grown to be so great a danger to us that it succeeded in pulling off what neither Hitler nor Stalin ever succeeded in doing, namely hitting us where we live on our own soil. And this has to be borne in mind when people poo-poo the power of the Islamo-fascist enemy.
And where do you see this World War IV going, if that's what it is, if it is against some kind of unified Islamo-fascist force, as you describe it? I mean, there's a very kind of Armageddon tone about the book. Is this a knockdown, drag-out, life or death, the West against the East, the West against a billion Muslims? Where does this go?
Well, I don't think it is a billion Muslims. Islamofascism is not the same thing as Islam. That's why a special term had to be coined for it. It's a political movement that developed within Islam, not in the 7th century when Islam was born, but in the 20th century when certain strands within Islam took political lessons first from the Nazis, who moved into the area during World War II. By the way, we have this on the testimony of the Islamofascists themselves.
But we already have troops in Iraq and Afghanistan. You're saying bomb Iran. Mm-hmm. Many are saying that might take us also into Pakistan. I mean, pretty soon you're in a lot of the Islamic world.
Well, yeah, but the question is what we're doing there, what we're trying to accomplish there. I think what we're trying to accomplish in World War IV is exactly what we were trying to accomplish in World War III, which mainly was to loosen the grip of a tyrannical totalitarian ideology on a major region of the world. In World War III, it was communism, the Soviet Empire. In this case, it's the Middle East and the Islamofascist regimes that prevail in every country of the region except Israel.
Mr. Budhortz, let me take a call from Burlington, Iowa. Eric, you're on the air.
Tom, thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have to disagree with the gentleman. Absolutely disagree. Saddam Hussein was a secular thug, and his job was to keep these Islamofascists under control. When we took him out, we gave the actual Islamofascists in Iran the opportunity to do what they've been trying to do for 10 years of fighting Saddam, which was to take over southern and eastern Iraq. This guy is trying to defend the war. The war took out the kind of guy we needed to keep these nuts under control. When Tito was out in Yugoslavia, look what happened. It's the same thing in the Middle East right now because of the war.
Eric, thanks for that. No one but Hortz. We don't have forever, so let's go straight to that. Now it's called the central battlefield globally by President Bush in the war on terror. When Saddam Hussein ran it, it wasn't pretty, but it wasn't the central battlefield either.
Well, I think it was one of the central battlefields in that Saddam Hussein was not merely a thug keeping Iran from dominating the region. He was himself a threat within the region and a threat to us, in my opinion. And I'm not even talking about the weapons of mass destruction issue. If you're going to fight back against the forces that attacked us on 9/11, incidentally, I do not say we should be plunged into World War IV. I think we were.
So we're
plunged
in it. Mm-hmm.
We're in it, and we were pushed in it on 9/11. The long range strategy that was adopted by the Bush doctrine and ratified incidentally by most Americans at the time, and including most members of Congress and even most Democrats, was that in the long run, we had to change the political configuration of that region. It was not enough to take out the Taliban. We had to drain the swamps in which Islamofascist terrorism grew. And we had to do that by replacing those regimes which had been giving aid and comfort to terrorists, which included Saddam Hussein. And the way to do that, sometimes it would be necessary to do it by military means. In other cases, diplomacy, sanctions, whatever, non-military means would be employed, if possible, and only military means only as a last resort.
But it's big military.
Which is
right
incidentally
now
what happened with Saddam Hussein.
Let me take some more calls, if I may. I know our time with you is short. Many people want to speak with you. Rob in Plainfield, Connecticut. Rob, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. You know, I hear this term Islamofascism. This is a new one. Anti-Semitism was the one before. But, I mean, I think we need to start talking about the Judeo-fascism of Norman Podhoretz and the fact that history is going to say that America was driven to commit a Holocaust in the Middle East at the behest of the Jewish lobby. And, you know, Mr. Podhoretz is an example of that.
Norman Podhoretz,
yeah, well,
what do you say to that?
I'm not going to argue with the blatant anti-Semitism of that question.
But you do raise it in your book. You go to this and say, let's look at it.
Let's look at what?
At the characterization that has been out there along the lines that Rob is just raising. I mean, you do pick it up in the book. What do you say to
that? I go through a very careful analysis.
Yes, you do.
Of Islamofascism. I'm not throwing around names or epithets. Very careful analysis based on statements that were made by the people involved. I go through a very careful analysis of the what I call the domestic insurgency and its various components.
You mean an American insurgency,
yeah.
which you call guerrillas with tenure. That sounds like an epithet, but is it not?
Guerrillas with tenure was a phrase invented by the socialist Irving Howe, late Irving Howe, talking about the people who took over the universities who had come up from the New Left in the late 60s. In any event, what you can argue with my analyses all you like, but I simply won't engage in the kind of abusive, vitriolic, anti-Semitic abuse that this caller has hurled at me.
Let's look at the domestic front, then. You are very, very tough on those who disagree with you. I mean, you call them, I mean, you raise this guerrillas with tenure phrasing, domestic insurgents, you call it. You say we're in the midst of a civil war here, almost as bloody as that in Iraq. That's quite a large comparison. Yeah. So what does all that mean? Do we, in your view, need a new McCarthy era to kind of get in there and weed out the appeasers?
Well, the McCarthyism these days is on the other foot. I mean, it's people like me who are being McCarthyized. But leaving that aside, what I call the domestic insurgency is made up of several different groups who are violently against this war. And I don't just mean Iraq. I mean the whole idea of World War IV, of a new world war, and who have, for various reasons, depending on where they stand, an investment in the failure of the Bush Doctrine, and they make no bones about it. I don't even have to go beyond quoting them.
You're saying don't truly believe it's wrong. They just want it to fail for their own personal gain.
Well, of course they feel it's wrong, and it's not a question of gain. I mean, but if you have a certain view of the world that is being challenged, in fact repudiated by the president. And you think your view of the world is right, and you're heavily invested in it, you will naturally, repudiate the challenge and hope that it fails because you think it's. Of course, you think it's wrong, but you also know that it makes your own ideas seem obsolete.
Let's go to Thillet, calling from Boston.
That's true of several of the groups that, I analyze very carefully and quote from the liberal internationalists, the isolationists, both on the left and the right, and many of the realists and many members of the mainstream media.
And you hang some very big and damning labels on them in that analysis. Let's go to Thillet, calling from Boston.
I hang no labels.
Guerrillas with tenure
don't come out of their own writings. Guerrillas with tenure, as I say, was not even my phrase. It's a phrase that comes out of the 60s.
Domestic insurgents, as in. Well, it's a big label. That's what I'm pointing to.
It's an insurgency mounted against the war we're in. Yes,
or it's American citizens who are critics of the war. I'm just saying it's two ways of describing it. One has a little more heat on it, doesn't it?
Why not? I mean,
hey,
sure.
Okay. Okay. Thillet's calling from Boston. Thillet, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I want to say thank you to the gentleman who wrote that book. Actually, we need a clear understanding of who our enemy is. And if we want to be successful in this war, we need to define, to understand our enemy. The problem of Americans, I am American too, but most Americans, they don't want to face the reality, and or maybe they are scared to name Islam. But it is a fact. We are in the war with these people, and we cannot deny the fact. And if we want to win this war, we need to understand our enemy very clear.
Thillet, we've got it, and your thumbs up for Norman Podhoretz there. Mr. Podhoretz, I've just got you for a minute. Let me ask you about two.
Glad to get some support.
You've got it right there. Let me ask you about two Americans in particular. You sat down not long ago with George Bush. Is he on the same page as you? And what about Rudy Giuliani, who you're advising and are in, I understand, in regular phone conferences with his crew? Is he on the same page as you?
Well, I think that he certainly agrees that we're in a world war and that we have to win it. I don't know that he agrees with every detail of my own analysis. I offer him advice, which he's free to take or reject. And I don't speak for him, and I don't dictate his policies. But my view is that his idea of the war is quite close to mine. And obviously so is George Bush's. I might say that my view of the war is close to his. He sees it as the succession to the last two totalitarian threats that came at us in World War II and World War III.
Do you see progress on the ground? When was the last time you were in these Middle Eastern countries and others that you're describing?
I haven't been in Iraq and Afghanistan at all. What I know is
Iran or no, Pakistan.
Never been in that region. What I know is what I read, and I read a lot. Try to follow what's happening. When I say it's going reasonably well on the ground, what I mean is that two totalitarian regimes have been toppled. The seeds of democratization have been planted both in Afghanistan and Iraq, which I believe will mature and grow and blossom. And as for Iran, it's another story. I mean, practically everyone in the world believes that it would be calamitous for Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. The argument is how to stop it. And what I did in my article and in my book is to, again, carefully analyze the various alternatives and try to show that nothing will work except military force. That is, neither sanctions nor diplomacy nor provoking an internal insurrection. And I try to say what the bad consequences would be of hitting them and measure those against the consequences of allowing them to get the bomb. And what I concluded was exactly what John McCain has said. The only thing worse than bombing Iran is allowing Iran to get the bomb.
Norman Podhoretz is author of World War IV, The Long Struggle Against Islamofascism. Mr. Podhoretz, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom.
We wanted Norman Podhoretz to debate it straight up with a critic of his policy. He didn't want to be on at the same time. But we have a couple of more voices. I'm going to bring in General William Odom is with us. Christopher Dickey of Newsweek magazine will join us in a moment. But let me go first to General William Odom, retired Army Lieutenant General, Director of the NSA, the National Security Agency, from 85 to 88. He was Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence for the U.S. Army from 1981 to 85, currently a Senior Fellow at the Hudson Institute, a Professor of Political Science at Yale. General Odom, thanks very much for being with us. What do you make of Norman Podhoretz's argument, his World War IV?
Well, it reminds me of a comment made by the French conservative François Revel. Jean-François Revel, when he said, ideology functions as a machine to destroy information, even at the price of making assertions in clear contradiction to the evidence. I think most of his comments have, from that his ideological view, sort of tramped on the evidence and pushed anything that's relevant against him aside. To compare World War III or the Cold War to what we're facing now, our strategy then was containment. Now it's preventive war. During World War III, we had lots of allies. In this war, we have almost no allies. We've dumped most of our allies. And we've put ourselves in a position of being on the offense. When Clausewitz pointed out more than 200 years ago, that the defense is always stronger than the offense as a form of war, particularly for long form. And staggeringly, you find the people most enthusiastic for us to bomb Iran, in addition to Mr. Podhoretz, is Osama bin Laden, and under the table, quietly spoken, the Russians. I find if I were him, I would be a little concerned about who my allies are.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. General Odom, do you see Norman Podhoretz's perspective on the world as having helped put the United States in the disadvantageous position you describe? Or are they related?
Hugely so. Taking on al-Qaeda made sense. Taking on Saddam and invading that country merely advanced the interests of al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda was ecstatic at the notion. In fact, people who track its recruiting, including the CIA, but not just them, many people in Southeast Asia, I heard a Singaporean expert go into this in detail a year ago. It was losing recruitment it was practically going out of business in the year 2000. By the summer of 2003, after it was clear we were bogging down in Iraq, recruiting started up and has been up ever since. I think bin Laden couldn't have been happier with our going in there. The other country, which has been very open and honest about this, and they're very pleased, that's Iran. Iran was banner from heaven for Iran for us to break the Ba'athist regime there. And once you knock over Saddam, instability just begins to flourish. And instability is what those groups that he probably would call Islamo-fascist, I think that is such a misleading label that you're going to become confused about who your enemies and your friends are if you use it, that the people who really are we need to worry about flourish. So the policies he supported so strongly from a military and a competitive point of view have greatly strengthened our enemy and weakened us, particularly in the strength we brought with our allies. And I know for neocons, allies is a bad word, but as Churchill said, the only thing worse than than allies is having no allies.
William Odom, General Odom, please stand by. I want to turn as well to Christopher Dickey. He joins us from Spokane, Washington, Middle East Regional Editor and Paris Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. Been reporting out of the Middle East for 20 years. Now his weekly blog is Shadowland. Christopher Dickey, thank you for joining us. Do you recognize the Middle East that Norman Podhoretz describes with his label Islamo-fascist threat?
Well, thanks, Tom. I'm a little bit confused. Islamo-fascist is supposed to be one idea, but it's supposed to embrace Islamic fundamentalists and Ba'athis, people like Saddam Hussein and Hafez al-Assad, who murdered Islamists by the tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands. They're somehow all part of the same movement. The only commonality they have is that they oppose U.S. interests and oppose Israeli interests in the region. So the whole premise seems to me specious. After that, the question of, is this a global war? You know, look, it is a global fight against what is essentially a very new kind of war, not a world war like one or two, or as he calls it, three, but a global insurgency where you have essentially weak players using sometimes subtle, sometimes extremely ruthless means to hit what they can where they can. And that's a whole different proposition than going in on a solid front and taking on whether the Soviet Union or the Germans or any other major state power.
Kathy is calling from Southborough, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
You're welcome.
This is a topic that's very much on my mind. I've been called a bleeding heart liberal, and I'm as anti-Bush as you can get. I think he's executed his policies in the most absolutely awful way. However, I think that Americans don't understand that we are dealing with an ideology that is not Western and rational. We revere life and we operate from that perspective. How do you engage this ideology and prevent it from taking over? They want to take over as much as the communists wanted a communist revolution in every country.
Kathy, we will pick up exactly that in just a moment. Let me get one more call first from Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Robert, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I gotta go real quick. I'm at work and I've been waiting on this.
Okay.
Here. I'm actually in the military. I'm a Navy corpsman. I just got back from Iraq a couple months ago.
Yep.
With Marines. I agree 100% with his views that this is, you know, a world war.
You agree with Norman Podhoretz then? Okay, let's hear it.
Yes, this is far past World War IV. We are probably in somewhere around World War 15. Our humankind has been at war since we were an infant as a species. So, I mean, it's just war has changed. We've got bigger and better toys to kill people with. That's how it is. And I think that anybody who tries to argue against this thought, or deny the fact that we are not in, you know, constantly state of war one way or another, is just trying to confuse themselves into making their life a little bit happier for the time that they're alive,
and then they can die peacefully and go on their own way.
All right, Robert, a Navy corpsman back from Iraq, let us pick that up as well, and thank you for your call. Let's see, we've got two here. General Odom, let me go first to you with our military caller's perspective. We are in a world war, he says. He's just back from Iraq. Humans always war. Life is war. And we've got to recognize it if we want to, you know, stand up and, I guess, win.
Well, I didn't say we're not in a war. I said we're fighting in a way that helps the enemy and hurts us. And the corpsman, he's seen things from the ground out there, and he understands what it is at that level. And I think he's right about what it looks like out there. But you're asking from a strategic point of view mm-hmm. whether we're helping our enemy or hurting our enemy, whether we are pursuing not tactics but a strategy that eventually promises some kind of success is another matter. And strangely, the analogy to try to understand Podhoretz's view that strikes me is when the war began to go against the Germans in Russia in 1943 at Stalingrad.
Mm-hmm.
And his generals advised him strongly to withdraw, cut the lines by nearly 1,000 kilometers, get nearly 1 million troops back to reinforce a narrower front. He was going to take it head-on, just like Bush, Cheney, and Podhoretz and Giuliani do. And the result was he lost the 6th Army, over 600,000 troops, and his line stayed long, and the war was much shorter, and he was defeated more quickly. It strikes me it's that kind of advice in the use of military power that is really a threat.
Mm.
And I would just say, finally, add up the score. If you're trying, but you need to know how many people are on each side. Well, we can take for granted that in principle, all the Arabs are on the other side. They're not on that now, but if we keep some of the policies going, we can make them all. And there are several scores of millions of those people. Right now, we've lost more in Iraq than we lost at 9/11. And even if they're taking more casualties, how long can you keep up killing the other side in a way that's going to have any kind of productive outcome?
Mm.
I think if you start looking at these hard-faced numbers from a strategic point of view, you begin to realize the corpsman's understanding is okay, but it just doesn't take into account the strategic realities.
Okay, there's the general responding to the corpsman on the military front. Christopher Dickey, help us out. Kathy says she's a bleeding heart liberal, but when she looks out, she sees an ideology at work here. That, you know, we're Western rational and life revering. It is not, and she, you know, you can hear some sympathy.
Who is Kathy talking about, really? Is she talking about Muslims? Is she talking about Arabs? Is she talking about hundreds of millions of people? Or is she talking about a very small handful of zealots who are trying to wage this campaign against the United States? In fact, she's talking about that handful. But the way Podhoretz and a lot of people in the United States talk about the Middle East and the Muslim world, all this talk about draining swamps, is essentially dehumanizing, as if everybody out there is essentially an insect or a reptile who couldn't possibly think the way we warm, loving human beings do. And that just isn't the case.
There you have it, straight up. Let's go to Mike in Columbia, South Carolina. Mike, you're on the air.
Oh, yes. Thank you for taking my phone call. I find myself in total agreement with your current guest and really disagreeing with your previous guest. So I just want to make a couple quick points. First of all, it's hard to give your previous guest credibility when he's never been there and when he's talking such sweeping generalizations.
But he's advising President – I mean, he's counseling President Bush, advising Rudy Giuliani. There's some kind of credibility there.
Yeah, it's kind of scary.
Or status.
And the problem with, I think, with his points, though, is that his rhetoric is reinforcing the Islamo-fascists, as he calls them, what they're saying about us. And I think the first problem that you need to do is need to not call them Islamo-fascists and just call them fascists. Because when you put in Islamo, you automatically bring the whole of Islam into it, and we need to separate these fascists from Islam.
But okay, let's go with that. Chris Dickey, I mean, everybody's trying to put some kind of frame around who the they is here. How do you look at it? Is that a useful exercise? Islamo-fascist, fascist at all, or something else entirely?
Well, in fact, fascism is a useful term to look at when describing certain parts of the Islamist movements and the political movements in the Middle East. That's not an unreasonable proposition. The unreasonable proposition is to present it as if it's some unified force. What happened in the 20th century is that the Muslim Brothers, the Baathis, even Al-Qaeda, learned a lot about organization. They learned a lot about developing cadre and cells and fighting insurgencies from a position of weakness. All of that's very important to understand in fighting this global insurgency. The problem comes when you say the best way to do that is to launch wars hither and yon using conventional means and impose occupation on populations that may not love the people who rule them, but they are certainly going to hate us once we're knocking down their doors and walking into their living rooms in the middle of the night.
Let's go to Anne in Somerville, Massachusetts. Anne, you're on the air.
Thanks for taking my call, Tom.
Yeah.
I identify myself as a Jew. Okay. I also identify myself as a human being and as a caring individual. There are many people in Israel, possibly even a majority, who would not identify with Norman Podhoretz's very, very narrow and polarizing point of view. What's happening in Israel is a failing of the United States to and the world at large to find a solution to what seems to be a very intractable problem that's inflaming both sides and drawing in religious people who don't belong in this fight.
But, Anne, you know, Norman Podhoretz says, I'll tell you how to solve this problem. I'll tell you how to address this intractable point of view. And then he lays out a very bold, agree or disagree, it's a very bold analysis of it. What do you say to it?
Well, what I say is that once upon a time, when the State of Israel came into being, there was a plan on the table from the United Nations to take Jerusalem and make it an international city so no one would fight over it and no one would try and invade territory in order to gain or deny access to it. And people were assassinated because of that point of view back in 1949. We need to go back to the where this all started from. There are terrorist acts on both sides. And we need to, everyone needs to step back from this.
And we've got it, and we appreciate your call very much. General Odom, if I may... Norman Podhoretz is very tough on Americans who do not share his point of view, calls them domestic insurgents, quotes the guerrillas with tenure, you know, kind of angle, says we're in a civil war at home, bloodier than that in Iraq over this. Wars do require a kind of solidarity, I suppose, but is it helpful to have that kind of branding of war critics, people with a different perspective on war?
If you're going to do that to the critics, you begin to undermine the U.S. Constitution. I mean, we don't have to get like the terrorists, and that's what he wants us to do. I think the last caller was right on about terrorists on both sides. Podhoretz, in his book, talks about how Saddam, the Baathists, took a lot of their party organizational techniques from the Stalinist and Leninist. Absolutely. But he omits to point out that a Jew, Hannah Arendt, who wrote brilliantly about totalitarianism, both fascist, Nazi, National Socialist, and Communist. And she also noted in 1948 and 49 that there were disturbing similarities between both the Nazi Party and the Communist Party on the one hand and the Likud on the other. He's very closely associated with the Likud, and Likud has provided those kind of terrorists in the past that your caller talked about.
Are you supporting that view? Are you saying that, and does that matter here?
What, that he supports the wrong side in Israel?
Well, I mean, that's a judgment call, I guess, but does it matter
to
the global question?
Yeah, it's the wrong side from the U.S. point of view, and I think for most of the Israelis. I agree with the lady who just called. If you follow Al-Haritz and a lot of bloggers in Israel, you begin to wonder if the regime out there really speaks for the majority of the public, just as you wonder if you listen to George Bush, whether he's speaking or whether Pence is speaking for very many Americans.
Christopher Dickey, how do you see it? Is it central? Is it important how this is debated in Israel? And how do you see Norman Pothoritz's view received there in your reporting?
Well, I think that Anne's perception is very much in line with sort of the very strong liberal current that exists in Israel. There are terrorists on both sides. There are a whole lot of reasonable and moderate people on both sides, too. And I think the hope for the future in the Middle East is that those people eventually will be given the voice. What happens when you take the position that Pothoritz does, where he's essentially trying to defend a disastrous war by accusing the accusers, is you close down the space for the moderates and you make the war last so much longer, ideologically, intellectually, physically, and militarily. It's just a disaster. And it's can we use the word evil? I think we might use the word evil for this kind of thing.
Let me take a call
it's a kind of neo-McCarthyism.
Well, we got big words going on all sides here. Wow, Steve's calling from Des Moines, Iowa. Steve, you're on the air.
First, I'd like to say that I disagree with current caller or current speakers
yes?
on 2 points. First of all, you know, they said that we launched the war, and in fact, war was declared on us, and eventually they hit us within our own borders. And if you approach a defensive strategy, which the current general believes is the best strategy, then we would have probably been hit again within the United States. France tried defensive war in World War II. It did not work. McClellan in the Civil War. And the defensive strategy, digging in on the East Coast and the West Coast, is probably not the strategy. Being attacked and being declared war, you have two choices.
Steve, our time is short. I think we've got the picture.
Can I just answer briefly?
Yes, please, General.
You remember, if you listened closely, I said I was all for invading the enemy's territory in Afghanistan.
Mm.
Attacking Iraq was another matter. This was to enforce your enemy's position. It was not a defensive. It did nothing to enhance your position. I'm not against the offense. I'm for using it effectively.
General Odom, let me ask you, our time is so short. Norman Pothoritz is advising Rudy Giuliani. He's sat down and counseled President Bush. Do you see his whole argument as the argument we're going to have in this country, or is it a cul-de-sac? Is this the main debate, or is this a sideshow?
No, I think it's a sideshow. I think the public slowly waking up to this. They're seeing that the cost of domestic programs squandering the kind of resources we are in Iraq, I think that's going to affect debate. The number of casualties coming back from the war is affecting debate. The fact that our army is practically torn up and can't continue the rate of operations out there. The failure of these ideologues like Pothoritz to support a draft. These kinds of things, I think, will move the argument against them.
And Christopher Dickey, does it matter to you when Norman Pothoritz says he has not visited many of these countries? Is that important in this debate?
Of course it does. He doesn't have a clue what he's talking about on the ground out there. And that enables him to do what you might call hyperconflation, where he pulls together all kinds of elements and makes it all sound like World War IV. Okay, let's say there's a global war. Let's look at Iraq as one front in that war. It's the same as the Russian front for Napoleon or the Russian front for the Germans during the war, as General Odom suggested, or, for that matter, Afghanistan for the Russians in the 80s, or Lebanon for the Israelis. It is a disastrous strategic mistake. And to defend it, he's willing to attack everybody in the world and call George W. Bush the greatest president we've ever seen.
Well, dear listeners, we wanted to have this debate with everybody on board at once. Norman Pothoritz wasn't up for that, but we gave you the best we could, and we're thankful to my guests here as well. Christopher Dickey, Middle East Regional Editor for Newsweek magazine, joining us from Spokane, Washington. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
And General William Odom, retired Army Lieutenant General. Thank you, General, for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.